really glad that you could be here with us today. You've had such a marvelous experience in your writing life. Would you tell us a little bit about the road that you've traveled to get this far?
Well, my writing career is what kind of used to be, at least, a sort of classic career. I started out, I had an interest in writing when I was in school. I wrote for the school newspaper, for school magazines, and so on. And when I went into the service, I spent a couple of years in the Coast Guard. I got into the journalism rating, they call it, working on our Coast Guard newspaper. It became a magazine, actually. And so after I got out of the Coast Guard, I went to journalism school. And at the same time I was in journalism school, I was able to get a job on a small newspaper. And it was a small daily newspaper in Napa called the Napa Register. And what had happened, you know, I guess like, you know, a lot of young people, I thought I'd just go out and work for Time Magazine or something. And so I gone into San Francisco and I went to Time Magazine. I went to Newsweek and the Associated Press and so on. And they all, finally this very famous old journalist at the AP told me, you know, you've really got to go and you've got to work on a small newspaper for a few years before you try to break in, you know, to the big publications. And so that's what I did. And I was able to get a job on a small newspaper, and it was great. I stayed there several years. I went from there to the Associated Press, became a correspondent for them. And then I worked there for a couple of years, and then I was hired as a correspondent for Business Week magazine in the city. And I was actually working for McGraw-Hill. I was a correspondent for McGraw-Hill, and they published Business Week and a number of other magazines. And it was really kind of an interesting, broad sort of spectrum. Besides their business publications, they were also doing things on health and education so it was really a nice wide-ranging experience. And they had an agreement both with the New York Times Service and with Reader's Digest. So I was able to do articles every couple of months. I'd do a piece for the New York Times Service. And they also had an arrangement with Reader's Digest where sometimes our articles were taken by the Reader's Digest. And that was really a very valuable connection because they started knowing who I was, and I went on and became what they called an originals writer. And I wrote stories that were original for the magazine, not excerpts.
So I thought that the Reader's Digest only published things that had been published somewhere before, and maybe they were excerpts and shortened, edited down. But they took original work, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They had a stable of writers who did original pieces for them, and I became one of those people, and it was really a very privileged, it was a wonderful time of freelancing. You know, they just treated writers wonderfully well, and they paid very well. And so I did that for a number of years, and then I wrote my first book, which is called Seasons of Shame, The New Violence in Sports, and they did excerpt that, and it was reviewed in the Times and so on.
So tell us a little bit about Seasons of Shame.
Well, Seasons of Shame was a book that I wrote based on some magazine writing that I did for Reader's Digest, for McGraw-Hill. I got very interested in the whole topic of sports violence and injuries, especially to young athletes. I had a very moving interview that I did in a separate story with it. Young high school kid who had been rendered a quadriplegic in a horrible football accident. And as I delved into it, I found, you know, that there were more and more of these examples of particularly kids who were getting hurt by the kinds of blocking and tackling they were doing in those days. And since
what time are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking now about the around 1980s.
Okay.
And so that book, that article was was then it was excerpted in the Digest, and the New York Times picked it up and ran a big Sunday reprint of it. So it kind of gave me the launch pad for my first book.
Well, I think that book must have also been instrumental in the movement that has taken place since then, where sports equipment is a lot more safe. The football players and the kids playing these sports are more protected, aren't they? And they're more conscious. The coach has to be more conscious. The schools have to be more conscious about the safety of the players.
Well, that's true. They changed the rules in the younger, in the high school and college rules to outlaw what was called stick blocking and stick tackling, where the player drove his head into the chest of the opponent, and which is leading to all sorts of horrible injuries. And there's still a long way to go, though. The professional football players now, you're starting to see a lot of attention being given to concussions and how serious they are and the kind of long-term brain damage that can result. And there's still a lot of the fields that are this kind of artificial grass, which is artificial turf, which is responsible for a lot of injuries. So there's still a lot of work to be done, but it did have a very strong effect on changing the game, especially for the younger players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that book then launched you. I kind of interrupted you there. It helped you get going with other kinds of writing.
Yeah. So I then followed with another book that was based in the Midwest. And I wanted to kind of move. I didn't want to get typecast in sports writing, so I did a book that was called Losing It, The Economic Fall of the Middle Class.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done during the time Jimmy Carter was president, and it was a terrible run of inflation, if you remember. And people would just have the feeling they were really sliding back. So I went to Muncie, Indiana, which had been the site of a famous sociological book called Middletown. It was written in the 20s by a professor and his wife, and then they came back in 5 or 6 years and wrote another book called Middletown Revisited. And the reason that they went there is because Muncie, they had determined by sociological analysis, was one of the most middle-class towns in the whole United States. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the chain restaurants used, there was a boulevard in Muncie, Indiana, and all the chain restaurants, national chains, would start out with a pilot store on this boulevard. So that's where I went, and I lived there actually for a couple of months and interviewed farmers and auto workers and all different kinds of people, and wrote that book, and it also got a lot of attention. It was excerpted in the Digest, and it got serialized in a lot of newspapers and went all around the country that way too. So,
is it possible to get serialized in newspapers now? Is that a thing of the past, or is it still happening?
I don't see that much anymore, but my book was picked up by a group called King Features, and it was a syndicate, and it was in about 60 newspapers for 4 days running, big papers, and so that was very nice.
So that kind of illustrates that there's been a major change in the way people write for newspapers and the type of material that the papers choose to publish. Serialization is, I haven't seen it. So these changes, you have to be able to move along with the changes that the papers are going through.
Yeah, I think the whole business of publishing has become so different and in some ways more difficult for writers. You do have the phenomenon of self-publishing, and you do have the phenomenon of the internet, which has opened a lot of doors for people, but then other avenues have declined or changed, and you're right. I haven't seen a serialized book in a newspaper for a long time.
Yeah.
But it was quite a nice thing.
Yes, it was. I remember I used to look forward to them. We've run out of time for our first segment. We'll be right back. Mm-hmm. We're back with Bob Yeager talking about his writing career. Bob, how did you then get from newspapers to doing more fiction?
Well, it was really the Digest experience, I think, that led me into fiction. Because in order to do the kind of, they called the a lot of the stories that I did true life dramas. Mm-hmm. And so you were expected to not just have the facts, but also to be able to put it into kind of a narration and with a lot of very vivid reporting. And it was very, very much used a lot of the techniques of fiction and a lot of emphasis on dialogue and so on. So eventually I decided that I wanted to get into fiction. And At that time, I was living in England, and I became fascinated with Harrods Department Store and decided I wanted to set a book there. And actually, I'm working on that book now.
Now, what was so fascinating about Harrods, for those who haven't been there?
Well, it's certainly one of the world's largest and most fabulous department stores. It's huge, hundreds, I think, 250 separate departments. They sell every kind of thing you can imagine. It's very elegant, very luxurious. You can have your funeral arranged with Harrods. For a long time, they had a lending library in the store. You know, they had barber shops and restaurants and Persian rugs. And it's, I think the motto is everything for everyone everywhere, and they really lived up to it. And this reputation of service and elegance. They have little carts, the horse-drawn carts, that if you live somewhere, I forget the perimeter, but they would, around the store, they would deliver things that you bought in these little carts, okay. Horse-drawn carts. So it's really like another world, and they have doormen at every door and so on. So I wrote the book, and I had some character problem with the book in that I had used a nom de plume kind of character built around Princess Diana. Mm-hmm. And when she died so horribly, it kind of chilled the book. I didn't know exactly where to take it. And so about that time, I started working on another book. I had been to a party with my cousin, who was a gemologist, and I'd asked him, you know, Ben, I said, what is the world's rarest precious stone? And he answered the Alexandrite. He said, it's the only precious gem that changes color. That's only found in a few places in the world, millions of times rarer than diamond. And I just started thinking about it, and I found out that it had been discovered in Russia in the 1830s. And I've always been fascinated with the Anastasia story, you know, the woman who claimed to be, you know, the surviving daughter when they were all, the Romanovs were all executed. So all these things were bubbling around in my head, and I started putting together a book called The Romanov Stone, and that you know, my newest book. As it happens, I'm going back now and I'm revising the Harrods book. And I'm going to try to tie it to the book that's published, The Romanov Stone.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah.
So that first book that had the Princess Diana character, mm-hmm. in it, I'm glad you're working on it again. Do you have a title for that book?
Yes, it's going to be called The Platinum Harrods.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So we'll know to look for that one.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, you do have The Romanov Stone. It's,
yes,
published. And it's, so tell us about that.
Well, the Romanov Stone is the story of a young woman, a college professor in living in Pennsylvania, in rural Pennsylvania, and her mother is involved in a fatal accident, or a near fatal accident, an accident that eventually does kill her. But on her deathbed, she reveals to this young woman a secret that she's been concealing all of her life, and that is that she is a descendant of Tsar Nicholas II, and because her great-grandmother, Anya Pujatin was her name, was a ballerina that Nicholas I had an affair with, and they had a child, and that child became her grandmother. So the way the story goes, Nicholas I, when Russia was going up in flames, he wanted to give his lover and their child something, and so he put an account in the Bank of England, which and this is where I used the Anastasia trials. I used the proceedings of the Anastasia trials, because in her trials, she maintained that the Tsar had created bank accounts for each of his children, and that claim was never refuted. The answer was, according to the bank, that the money had been used to fight World War I. But Anastasia always claimed, or Anna Anderson, claimed that the Tsar would never have done that, and that the money was still there. That dispute was never resolved, but that was real. And my book is fiction, and so I just assumed that the Tsar had set up another account for his child, and that account was still in the bank. And the Tsar had also prescribed that to obtain that bank account, the claimant had to present a special Alexandrite that had been cut by the Fabergé, the House of Fabergé, which was in Moscow, and the stone and a special carriage, because Fabergé, as you may know, they made these beautiful carriages for the royalty, these little miniature carriages, and they would put the jewels and the little eggs and so on that they made, they put them inside. And so in the book, The Romanov Stone, this young woman who learns all this, she realizes, her mother tells her, you must find this treasure, this heritage of ours, and you must use it to restore the Romanov name. So that launches her on a journey, and she eventually goes to New York. She meets a very respected gemologist, and the two of them wind up going across Europe searching for the stone at great risk. And she's pursued by Russian mafia and by Colombian jewel thieves and so on. So that's quite a story.
Right, it is quite a story. Yeah. It is. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We're talking with Bob Yeager about his book, The Romanov Stone. Now, Bob, you've got great character development, I can tell, by the way you've set up the people. You've got all these characters with all these different motivations and things driving them. That shows me that you're following a kind of a formula to write this. How did you develop that formula?
Well, I started with the idea of this problem of this young woman who learns, with very little warning that she's got this inheritance and this legacy and really kind of discovering really who she is. And so the book really becomes a journey and trying to find out where the stone is, and in the process kind of finding out who she is too. And so that's kind of it's a quest. So that's kind of how the framework of the story works.
And then you've got the secondary characters and other primary characters who each have their own motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So every character in your book has a definite purpose and a definite quest of their own.
That's right.
And that's probably, for those of us who are working on developing our own book, it's probably a good thing to keep in mind. Look at your characters and make sure that they have a purpose for being there. Because you might have people, characters taking up space in your book who really don't add to the story, move it forward, or have a purpose that drives the book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also, so when did this book come out, Bob?
It's been out a few months, and it's available on Amazon and, all the other online outlets. It's available as a hardback, as a softback, as ebook, and I'm kind of excited because it's going to be available as an audiobook, and I've got a very talented narrator who's working on it, and it should be ready probably sometime in November, so it's going to be something you can listen to as well as read.
Well, that's fabulous. Now, who's your publisher? You've got it in hardcover and paperback.
Yes. It's published by Abbott Press, And as I say, it's not on the online outlet that's also available, of course, from the publisher.
Now, you're such a seasoned writer. Did you go the route of getting an agent, though, to find a publisher for you?
Well, you know, I did. It's sort of a long story. The book was actually optioned by a movie producer. We were going to sell it as a book, but we had a hard time finding a publisher, oddly enough. And then all the self-publishing was burgeoning, and so we just decided to go ahead and do it ourselves. So that's how we did the book.
Oh, so it is self-published?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've had really a kind of a good experience with it. I had a lot of control, and the business has changed so much. That was another thing that kind of influenced us, because while we were kind of going out and looking for agents and so on, the bookstores, a lot of the large bookstores were shutting down.
Mm.
So it just seems like all the marketing and so on is moving online anyway. And so that's the way we did it.
So what advice do you have for people who have a book that they want to put out there? What can you tell them about pitfalls or things that they really should do or should not do?
Well, I think the main pitfall for most books is that they just aren't good enough. And so if you're going to publish it yourself, you've really got to make sure it's as good as any book that can come out of New York. And you've got to have people edit the book, and you really got to have a finished product.
How did you find your editor?
Well, this is the producer, the movie producer that was involved in the book for us.
Oh, okay. How did you find the movie producer?
Well, he found me, really. He's a fellow that he and I worked together for quite a few years on magazine pieces, where I would do a piece for the Digest or Ladies Home Journal or one of those outlets, and he would then market those as movies for television, that kind of thing. One story I did for the Digest, he pitched as a series, and so we'd worked together back and forth for quite a while. And when he found out that I was doing this book, he became absolutely in love with it and wanted to produce it as a feature film. But I wanted us to get a book out first, and so that's when we went the kind of traditional route, and we just found the business was just in such turmoil and so on that I decided just to do it myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah. Well, why don't you read something to us from the book?
The Stone First Kind of Comes to Be.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's set in 1831.
Okay, so give us the background of what you're going to read, Bob.
Okay, well, this is really at the opening of the book. And it's really kind of the first dramatized scene. It's based on absolute fact. The Alexandrites were discovered in the Tokovaya River region of the Ural Mountains in western Siberia. And the legend is that they were found, the first one was found by a peasant. And so this section relates that story through the eyes of a worker in the Tsar's jewel works, who brings this stone for the first time to the attention of Nicholas I. And the time is June 1831. The gemstone lay on a small plump cushion of white silk. In the private chambers of the Tsar of all Russia, it glittered darkly like wet winter grass. "It is an especially large emerald," Nicholas I observed. His tone seemed distant. He walked across the room and gazed out a window. In the summer of 1831, with revolutionary fervor sweeping Western Europe, the state of his empire's armies was a greater concern to the Tsar than his lapidaries. "This is precisely what was so unusual, sire. It is not an emerald." 8 months earlier, a charcoal peddler had been making his way along the banks of the Tokovaya River in western Siberia. Slogging through the snow, his shoes wrapped in rags were worn. The man came upon a large tree, upturned by a storm the night before. In the exposed roots, the peasant found a cluster of stones he believed were emeralds. A few weeks later, he took them to Ekaterinburg, center of the Tsar's cutting and polishing operations. The emissary from the emperor's jewel works cleared his throat. It was under illumination, he recounted, that the lapidus first saw the extraordinary properties of these stones. A small party journeyed to Tokovaya, and more were found. This was the largest. Nicholas returned to the small table. His towering figure made the cushion and its contents seem tiny and insignificant. He would not have added this meeting to an 11-hour day had not the Urals mining operations grown steadily more important to the Romanov first. "No displease, Your Highness," his visitor said. "Size is not what distinguishes this stone. This is what sets it apart from all others." The visitor lit a small kerosene lamp with a polished reflector and a brass-ringed focusing lens. He aimed its beam directly into the stone. In an instant, the gem that had appeared to be an emerald flared into a ruby. Its purplish fire rose from the cushion like a vermilion sunrise. "Astonishing!" Nicholas exclaimed. The man from Ekaterinburg put down the lamp and moved around the table to stand daringly close to his liege. "Your Highness," he gushed, "consider the colors, green and red, the imperial colors. There is something else, sire, if you will permit me." The emperor, some called the handsomest nobleman in Europe, nodded. "The gem's discovery was confirmed on April 30 of this year, the same date as the 18th birthday of his young Highness Alexander." "Indeed, Majesty, the lapidus called this the Tsarevich Stone."
"Wow. Have you seen one of these stones?"
"Yes, I have. They're very, very rare. But one of the people I interviewed to prepare the book is a very well-known geologist and curator of museums and so on. His name is Peter Bancroft, and he lives in Fallbrook, California now.
Mm.
But he's journeyed all around the world looking for precious stones, and he's a real expert in Alexandrite, and he's been to this region. And he's shown me the stones, and uncut, they're just dark, greenish stones, and it's very easy to understand why they were confused with emeralds. But when you see a really good one, and like I say, they're quite rare. You could go into Tiffany in San Francisco and ask to see one, and the chances are they won't have one.
Wow. Yeah. Fabulous. We'll be back with more from Bob Yeager. Okay, we're back with Bob Yeager, and we've been talking about his book, The Romanov Stone. I was asking Bob about the craft of writing and how, what other advice he has for us about, you don't just get to write a novel like this without having done a lot of other things in the past to build yourself and get ready for it. So what can you tell us about that?
Well, I think the advice I would have is to try and have as many tools in your writer's toolbox as you can. And you really need to take a look at writing for business, whatever direction that might take, in advertising or marketing, and have some skills like that that can keep you earning money, because writing, being a writer, is a small business in a way, and so you need to have some tools that can bring you some income. And also, you learn pieces of the craft as you do these things. In the last 10 years or so, I've done a lot of speech writing for businesses and for professional people, and it's not only something that earns money, but it also is very useful in learning to write voice which is something you directly use in fiction. My experience, I think I talked earlier about writing for the Reader's Digest and how a lot of that kind of writing, and I did the same kind of writing for some of the women's magazines, maybe some of them, and Family Circle and Woman's Day and some of those, and they all are looking for that kind of dramatic writing that is very much not fiction writing, except it's true. And so the more different kinds of things you can do, and just prepares you better.
How would one break into writing for some of these magazines? Do you submit your work? Do you contact someone and ask for an interview? Do you write a letter? How do you get into it?
Well, the first step is usually to get something very exciting, that something you see in your local paper, and then write a query letter. And the way I've always tried to do it is to write a query letter that really captures the editor in the first page, if possible, page and a half max, and that dramatizes your story just as you would in the magazine itself in the opening, so that they're pulled in immediately, and then they get a sense that you can do it. You make a point that you're in the area, or that you have some connection to the subject, and you put in some of your past credits and see what you can do. And you be prepared to write many of those.
You don't expect the first one to get through it.
Right.
Yeah.
Very true.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now we're going to go back to the Woman of Stone, and you're going to read something else for us. Where are we now in the story?
Okay. Well, this is, as I said, Kate winds up searching across Europe, and she finally, she picks up some clues, and she finally realizes the fact that she knows where the stone is, that it's hidden in a place in the Ukraine Republic, in the city of Kiev, in the St. Sophia monasteries, which are hundreds of years old, and which for centuries the priests buried themselves in the monks in the caves and caverns of this monastery. And so Kate finally, through all her digging around and detective work, she believes that she has found the coffin in which the Romanov stone has been hidden. So here we have her down in the darkness. She snuck in there at night, completely illegal.
Is she by herself?
Oh, yeah, she's by herself. She's wearing kind of a black spandex outfit, and she's, you know, she's got a flashlight and a couple of a bag of tools.
So she's kind of like a burglar.
Yeah, very much. Standing, Kate shrugged and rotated her head to relieve the tension in her back and shoulders. Then she reached across the coffin. It's kind of appropriate for Halloween, isn't it?
Yes,
yeah.
It is, yes.
She rotated her head to relieve the tension in her back and shoulders. Then she reached across the coffin, and grasping the thick glass, the coffin was covered with a glass cover, turned it on its axis so that it rested crossways, fully exposing the dead priest's upper and lower body. Kate searched again, this time reaching under Father Mikhail's form. Beneath his right shoulder, her fingers touched something firm and round. Frantically, her hands dug at the rotting leather beneath the body. Whatever she felt, she couldn't budge it. If only she could shift the cadaver out of the way. Kate walked to the casket's head. Leaning over, she tried not to look at the priest's closed, sunken eyes. Inserting both hands just below the neck, she flattened her palm against his shoulder blades. His corpse felt like a hard leather husk. Tightening her knees and belly for greater power, Kate lifted her body straight up. Crack! A dry, splintering sound ruptured the silence. The mummy's head had broken off at the neck and now lolled awkwardly back from its desiccated body. The priest's upside-down, pie-shaped face blindly ogled her, his trunk gaping open toward the ceiling. From his now mutilated form, the stench of trapped dead air and rotting clothes escaped like a volatile gas. enveloping her. Kate stifled a scream and dropped the flashlight, fighting nausea. Get hold of yourself. Pick up the flashlight and get on with it. Kate slid her hands beneath the ruined cadaver until she again felt the object. It seemed surrounded by material, as if in a satchel or purse. Kate tugged the container and it started to move. In an instant it lay in her hands, heavy, about the size of a pear, in a gathered velvet pouch. In the darkness, the 31-year-old professor sank to the floor and splayed her legs like a little girl. She clutched the pouch to her chest with both hands. You found it. My God, you actually found it. She loosened the drawstring and drew out the pocket-sized book bearing the inscription in faded gold, Bank of England, private account. Next, she withdrew what could have been a large potato. Without her flashlight, the miniature Fabergé carriage would have been almost impossible to see. Reverently, Kate placed the piece on the floor. She shined the beam directly upon it. The egg-shaped container's glistening enamel surface gleamed like colored vapors. She touched the top with her finger and heard a solid click. Slowly, Kate partially opened the egg. As she did so, her flashlight bathed the stone, causing it to emit a bright crimson glow. Kate's heart pounded. Suddenly, she was seized by panic. What if the authorities found her? She heard of the Tsar's prisons where inmates' leg irons were removed only upon death. What if she were caught stealing, as both Ukrainian and Russian law would surely define it, a state treasure? Abruptly, she closed the Fabergé container and jumped up, brushing the basket. The glass cover momentarily teetered, then slid to the hard floor. It shattered in a dozen sections, clattering into a jagged crystalline heap. Kate froze, paralyzed by the cacophony that echoed through the cavern. She had to get herself under control, think through her options. What options? She had zero time. She had to get out of here. Slinging the tool bag over her shoulder, she grabbed the pouch with her free hand, then bolted back toward the stairs. She pulled open the heavy door to the cave and an instant later was outside, sprinting free. Behind her, a window being raised creaked in its jams. Kate heard muffled shouts. Lights blinked on in the cathedral. She dumped her burglar's bag in a trash can and kept running. Only a trained athlete could catch Kate Cavill in full flight. By the time the curious few had convinced themselves they'd heard only an animal, she'd reached the edge of the city. The monastery of the caves again lay shrouded in darkness.
Oh, and this is from the looks of it, is about halfway through the
book. That's right.
She's got all these people who are going to be chasing her.
Chasing her, and the stone, she has the stone, then she doesn't have the stone, and so there's a whole lot of adventure to go.
Oh, my. That's going to be a great book. Well, best of luck with it.
Thank you, Linda. Thanks very much.
So there you have it, folks, another Man's Anita Voices. I hope you got a lot out of this conversation with Bob about his writing history, how he got to be where he is now. And right now I'd like to thank Bob Yeager once more for coming on and talking about about writing and about the Romanov Stone. Hope you folks have a great week. Come back and see me again next time on Man's Anita Voices.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.